so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah.
All right. We're back. It's another episode of the Toy Department. I'm Derek Madden. He is Matt Kolsky. How you doing today, man?
I'm pretty good. I am pretty good.
So I have I have an update on the Drake concert ticket situation.
Oh yeah.
We broke up.
Oh.
And you know what? I wish I thought of it sooner.
The breaking up?
Yeah, would have just saved me a lot of trouble.
That's heartbreaking. Yeah. So you broke up before you ever had to buy or not buy Drake tickets?
No, unfortunately, I did buy the tickets.
Oh, man.
And they cost me pretty penny.
At least you don't have to go.
I'm still going to give them to her, and then I don't have to go. So,
All right.
I guess everybody's a winner.
Congratulations, I guess.
Congratulations, I think.
Yeah, you know, we move on.
You should be congratulating the ladies of the Twin Cities Tinder.
There it is.
They're the big winners in all of this. All right, so we're going to try to do, I think, a little mini episode today because both of us have a lot of things going on, some of which we'll get into. And it's the summer. It's a little bit slow out there from a pop culture standpoint.
Man, is it. And what is that? Is that... So obviously TV slows down a little bit in the summer, which I think is probably like TV people being like, well, folks want to go outside. Is that it? Is that the I guess there's only really baseball is going on in the sports world.
And not even that right now, technically. I think it's a function of actually even a little bit minier than a phenomenon than that. It's just kind of 4th of July, right?
It gets 4th of July has like gravity that
there's like a specific lull right now, right? Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
You've got sports, you know, the soccer tournaments, which kind of at least had my attention, and I think some other people's those ended.
Hey, right? I watched the Euro final.
And then you got baseball, which is kind of sort of deliberately all-star breaks right around this time.
Right.
So that stuff slows down. We're sort of pre the Olympics. On the political side, we are pre the conventions. So
all of
those kind of shows are taking time off. You just kind of came to the natural end of the run of the prestige cable dramas. So your Game of Thrones and your Silicon Valleys and those end, and they haven't quite started up the new things yet.
Well, there are like a few, I don't know if you call them B prestige TV shows that are still rolling, because you've got Preacher, you've got Ray Donovan.
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff on. Nobody's going to vacate
entirely.
Yeah, but
it's a much shorter slate, no doubt.
But, Mr. Robot comes back this week.
Yeah.
We got a couple of new HBO shows premiering on Sunday. And I think things will just sort of pick up again from there. The Olympics is a TV show that I think people watch, I guess. And that's coming soon, right?
The point is, like, we're in a lull now, but in 2 weeks we'll be behind again.
Yeah. So, maybe go outside and appreciate it.
Hurry up and get outside while you still have the chance.
Let's talk about two things that debuted in the lull and maybe not together. Do you want to quickly tackle the home run derby?
Yeah, and all-star games in general, I think, is an interesting point, and when better to do it than now.
Yeah, is it just – this is one of those things where I can't tell if it's me tuning out as my life gets as you get older and you just care about things that are less important, and there's nothing that's easily more kind of slough-offable of your sports fan schedule than a home run derby and an all-star game. Or if it really is just that these things are less relevant as spectacle. I actually suspect it's the latter, but I'm kind of curious as to what you think about that.
Well, I think if we talk about the peripheral events around All-Star stuff. You know, the home run derby here, I think the dunk contest is similar. I guess you could throw the hockey skills challenge in there, although I think that's the best of them. I think those have lost relevance. And it's hard for me to say why, although I have a sneaking suspicion it's as much about the increase in quantity of available watching options as anything. Because, look, fundamentally, what the home run derby and the dunk contest in particular are, because the Pro Bowl's trash, so let's throw that out. But what the home run derby and the dunk contest are is the thought of what's the most exciting thing in our sport, and let's just do that for a day. What I think has become the case is that the most exciting thing in the sport in both of those situations is really mostly exciting because of the way it happens during the sport.
Yeah, divorced from context, it's not that exciting. I mean,
I think that's more true of home runs than of dunks, because out of competition dunks, you can at least get really wacky and do crazy stuff. And sometimes we've had great dunk contests with guys doing crazy stuff. I mean, I think of the Dwight Howard Nate Robinson battle.
Yeah, and your home run derby, right? Your only move is to hit it really, really far. That's
exactly
that's the best you can do.
Well, Stan did that yesterday again and again, 61 times. Hit more than anyone before him, and probably some as far as anyone before him. He was awesome to watch. But, man, if you think the standing around between dunks is boring, watching 2 hours of people just swinging at BP is excruciating.
Yeah, I didn't watch any of it, so I can't. And I can't even conceive of, like, tuning in to watch 2 hours of it. Just, I mean, why in life? And it's a little harder for me because I feel like the home run derby in itself is sort of inextricably linked with Chris Berman.
Yeah, that's a problem.
And I'm just out. I'm just
you got to mute it. I mean, it's a Fall Out Boy concert followed by Chris Berman going back.
Yeah, like
you got to mute. You have to mute the whole broadcast.
And it's like I can't. There's no way I can't even sign up for 5 minutes of Berman shtick. So there's no way I could sign up for 2 hours of
it. 5 minutes. Yeah. I can't sign up for 30 seconds.
I mute Monday Night Football half times.
He's awful. I mean, he's an embarrassment.
I just can't. And I, like,
not to mention we've seen what the guy's like behind the scenes. Why does this guy work?
Well, you know, purportedly he's going to retire after this coming season. So I'll be curious to see, you know, if my feelings for the event change Berman-less, but I don't think it will.
I'll say this. It would be more interesting if they use that time to have an interesting baseball conversation instead of literally try to do play-by-play for the same thing happening over and over again.
Right. It's just honestly, just thinking about Chris Berman hypothetically calling a home run derby right now bums me out.
Back, for sure. Here's my question. Is there any skills competition or event of any kind baseball related that you would be more interested in on the day before the All-Star game?
I don't think so. I think the key word is competition. And I'm sort of thinking about all these sports, and kind of in my head I was like, well, maybe there was a 3-point, you know, shootout thing that would be interesting to me or something, but it would be interesting to me because of the stakes, because of the competition. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like the league is such a 3-point shooting league where if you really had the best guys and it was really something. The problem is just context. Like, it needs to mean something. You know, like NBA All-Star Weekend, where the players were sitting around betting their own actual money on, like, a game of horse or, you know, a 3-point shootout or something like that, where there was, like, stakes and people cared, that's what I would watch. And that's why I'm not interested in any of these All-Star games, because no one cares. You know, they're
I think
friendly soccer
sometimes.
Games, and they're games without defense, And they're,
okay,
you know.
Okay, hold on. Wait. Yeah. Two things. First of all, I think people sometimes do care about the three-point contest and dunk contest. I think it depends entirely on the field and on.
By the way, when I say people, I do mean participants in this case. I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, I know. You don't think last year's three-point contest they cared? I think they did. I think it was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, maybe. And I think that's what made it the most interesting of whatever was going on.
Yeah, well, and even the dunk contest, which didn't have huge names,
right,
had an intense competition in it this year. Yeah. So I think some of it is.
But you need the best dunk. Right. And people said it was one of the best in years. But I think, you know, until you get the guys that we know are really the best dunkers and the best, you know, generally they have the best 3-point shooters. They do a decent job of that.
Yeah.
But
it would be a phase shift to get guys like LeBron in there.
Yeah.
And it would certainly, it would key it up. But I actually, that's why I actually stand by the NBA All-Star Game, is I think the guys do care to a degree. Now, the game itself is a bit of a different story.
The game, they don't.
But that's where, in baseball, I think in the game, they do kind of care. They are trying, and
kind of. But there's a whole, the baseball game itself has the whole, you know, almost little league-ian. Like, everybody, you know, everybody's going to pitch an inning, and everyone's going to, we're going to, if they played that game like a real, like, managed it like a real game with an actual starting pitcher, you know, and real bullpens, you're a lineup where you're playing the best guys.
A couple things. First of all, they are playing great guys. So,
there's a lot of not great guys in every All-Star game. It's just the nature of the beast.
Most of the not great guys don't play these days.
Everybody gets in, pretty much, right?
No, certainly not pitchers. Not these days. And I think often you got a handful of hitters that sit as well. I mean, I think they try to squeeze them in for an at-bat or something, but there's a lot of really good players playing in the All-Star Game. And just in terms of the flow of the game, the baseball All-Star Game is the most like a regular baseball game in terms of the way they play.
In terms of the actual, I guess, the actual gameplay, because you can't really, there's no real way to really change the gameplay other than you can hard or not, you know what I mean? Like, I guess.
Right. Well, that's why in this situation, I do think that the baseball All-Star game is the closest to a regular game.
Yeah, but it's still not a regular game. You know what I mean? Like, I think guys throw fairly hard, but I also don't. Like, it's not the same in terms of, like, I think the hunger to get guys out or to use all your stuff or,
maybe,
you know,
not
what I mean?
Don't you get some feeling of competition when you watch it, just in terms of guys? Isn't there some excitement in the best pitchers in the AL going after the best hitters in the NL?
No.
I mean, less so with interleague play, maybe, but I do think there's something there with the baseball All-Star game.
No.
Like, not for you.
It's on tonight, right?
It is.
If I'm sitting around doing, you know, and if I'm in front of a TV and kind of like, I don't think I will be. I have plans. But if I was, I might turn it on. I might Orange is the New Black.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, we should talk about Orange is the New Black at some point. I haven't finished this season, but I will. And do you know my friend Julie Lake is on that show?
I have
a friend on Orange is the New Black.
I didn't know you had a friend, Julie Lake. Who does
my
she play?
Julie. She plays Angie Rice, who is the really stupid brunette meth head.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know exactly who that is.
And I could easily reference plot points from this season, but I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, she's a fairly pivotal role. I'm almost done with the season, so we can talk about that next week.
Oh, okay. Well, then, quick spoiler alert. Cover your ears, everybody. But my friend Julie is the shower shitter.
Yes. Indeed.
And yeah. Anyway, so
she gives that up. let's talk about that next week, and let's move quickly now to.
Quick question first.
Okay.
All star stuff. If you were in charge of any of these leagues, well, okay, let's say just the two, right? Because hockey, I'm not really sure, and obviously we'd all cancel the Pro Bowl if we could. If you were in charge of baseball or basketball, would you cancel the All-Star game? Would you try to change it? Would you rather just do away with it or fix it?
That's, you know what, that is a really good question. I don't. Yeah, if I were those two, because of the tradition around it, I would probably try to fix it. I don't know what the easy answer to that is in 2016. I don't think I don't see how you get guys to play hard. And I don't think, other than trying to create some sort of outlandish stakes, which are pretty hard to do. Like, it's pretty hard to make guys that are this rich really care about something.
Well, except that we know that one thing rich people love is more money. So, I mean, I think that would be the obvious attempted fix is drop a grip of cash on the winners or something. But that would it would have to be an awful lot of money.
It would be. I don't know. I think it's a tough fix for either one of those things to matter. Yeah. And I feel like the incentive is low. Like, if you're the NBA, you just go into the game, you know people aren't going to play defense, and you know that there are going to be a bunch of dunks, and that's going to be – and the score might hit 200. You know?
Yeah, but there are people who like that, like, you know, psychos like me.
Yeah. Really? Do you enjoy watching the NBA All-Star game?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
because I enjoy it for exactly what it is. I want to watch the best players in the world one time a year play pickup basketball and have fun. I enjoy it that because I like basketball that much, and I like watching the way they interact that much. And I like to – look, if every basketball game was a bunch of dumb alley-oops, that would be stupid. But once a year, I can dig on it.
Not me. I'm out. Yeah, just out.
Well, I recognize that I'm the minority position there, and you know, if I was in charge, I would try to fix it. I'm just, like you, outside of putting a whole bunch of cash on the line, I'm not really sure what that fix would be.
I mean, they can't even get rid of the Pro Bowl, which is the most obviously useless.
Well, okay, but the NFL can't do anything to get out of its own way, so I'm not sure we should.
And people watch it. More people watch the Pro Bowl than any of these other All-Star things we're talking about.
That's so insane. I don't know what to do with that information.
So there's no incentive for them to take it off.
No, that's right.
All right. So were you among the people who checked out the night of? I'm assuming you were, because we're going to talk about it. It'd be awkward otherwise.
Yeah, it was homework. I do my homework. I've always been a good homework student. Look, I may not put the time into my homework that my teacher wants, but that assignment gets turned in.
All right. Well, let's talk about it a little bit. What do you think?
I mean, okay. First of all, two thumbs up. It is wonderfully intense, and after one episode, I think feels more I feel more invested in the outcome than I would have expected. I also think one thing they did a great job with is when you sit down to watch a show like this in 2016 in America, you've seen so much, you've read so much, you've heard so much already. And I think this show, maybe as well as any I've seen in, after one episode, uses that I was going to say against you, but not in like a nasty way, uses that to play to your sensitivities and the way you look at things emotionally. Since I went into this, and there are going to be slight spoilers from the first episode, but since I went into this knowing there's going to be a murder mystery and this main character is going to be accused of something that maybe he did not do, every single step he took in episode one as they sort of laid the framework of this story, I found myself on the edge of my seat thinking, oh man, is this what is the, here's a mistake he made. Oh man, here's something. This is going to come back to bite him later. Oh, this is going to look so guilty. And
yeah.
Just
like that knowledge, it almost creates that sort of like you're watching it like, you know, like that old school horror movie kind of vibe of like, don't go in the closet.
Yeah.
What are you
no.
Don't go.
What are you doing? You can't go in there.
Don't
you know not to
cab.
Go to dark places alone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No. You know? And so the whole thing is imbued with that sort of tension and intensity. And I also – look, man, I love John Turturro. Not only have I loved his work for his whole career, but he was in a film about sort of relatives of mine. My father's cousin wrote a great autobiographical book years and years ago.
Rounders?
Called Unstrung Heroes. And the movie starred Torturo and Andy McDowell. And not only was he wonderful, but he also is a wonderful man. And so I have fond feelings for him already. But I love a part like this for him, where he's sort of this not exactly downtrodden, but a little bit marginalized and beaten down sort of a guy with a good heart, but a little bit of an edge to him. I think it's the perfect sort of character for him.
Yeah.
The sort of slump-shouldered hero, if you will. And Riz Ahmed is awesome. And I completely believed the sort of brief couple-hour relationship that he gets himself into. I thought they did just a great job of painting that. And I like all the textures of, you know, you sort of see the before and after of a crime being committed, and you don't see the crime itself, but the way they layered it with you know, different details of what the neighbor sees, and you see some stuff through security camera angles. It just, it does an incredible job of setting up this mystery and making the stakes high enough that I'm locked in.
Yeah, the acting performances are tremendous. Nice to see Bodhi getting some more work.
Love Bodhi. I think one of the guys from The Wire produced this or wrote this, right? Mm-hmm. So not that surprising. But Bodhi was always one of, if not my favorite, Wire character, and I love seeing that actor around.
He's good on Oz too. But yeah, the performances are great. But what I like is it's nice to see a show that does little moments this well. You know, like so much, I think, of the show is a well-timed glance or a scene like spoiler alert, when they when he's in the police station and you know he has the knife on him and they're doing this search, and it lasts for, you know, the scene itself kind of, you know, has these sort of stops and starts where it really probably lasts like 4 minutes. You know, I'm just saying that based on feel, but it goes for a while.
It's and long, you know, for a scene where you essentially know what's going to happen.
Right. And it just draws it out, and it's gut-wrenching, as you know eventually they're going to, you know. And there's so many little points along the night where you think, like, oh, maybe they're going to let him go, you know.
Right. Maybe this is how he slips away. But at the same time, you kind of – you know what's coming, because we know that the show is going to be this mystery about did he do it, and can he be exonerated if he did not. That you know he's going to end up caught, and yet you're sitting there watching him slowly get caught, and it's incredibly dramatic. I think that is, you know, that's something from a more macro view, that idea of manufacturing tension and intensity in a way that feels real and legitimate instead of forced. That is something that I think is a hallmark of a lot of our favorite shows, as a podcast, but as a society, you know, where stuff that shouldn't necessarily be so dramatic because we kind of understand the outcomes and consequences becomes dramatic because of the way it's put in front of us, because of the acting performances. And, you know, it's almost like the more good people and good efforts you have in the various aspects of creating a show, the more you're able to create that narrative tension. Just based on the performances and the content, as opposed to the plot.
Yeah, it's a fuller, richer world, really, and it reminded me a lot of you know, the eye for detail that Vince Gilligan show would have, or a David Simon show. You mentioned The Wire earlier, and I really like that aspect of it. And I'm just generally excited to see where it goes next.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of the two sides of a great show to me. Is there's the, you know, because look, I think we fancy ourselves, and maybe it's a highfalutin position to take, but we fancy ourselves as sort of educated viewers that think about things on a somewhat artistic level when we're watching a show like this. And then there's also just the, like, pure, am I excited to watch next week effect, you know, on a more base level. And I think this really succeeds in both, where I'm invested in the plot on a surface level, and just from a, like, man, what's going to happen next? And I also, after watching it, really thought a lot about the way it was shot and the way they did things and just how impressive that was. And yeah, you are getting into the pantheon of really great shows when you talk about shows that – now, look, this one is shorter and has work to do, and as much as The Wire managed to hold that for 4.5 seasons, but it's that level of excitement where it's both entertaining on its face and just really artfully done.
Yeah. Talking about this makes me curious to see where you're going to fall on Mr. Robot.
Have we talked about it in the past?
I don't think we have really talked about it a ton. Okay. So yeah, I'll save my thoughts for that for maybe next time we get together after we can talk about the season premiere.
Do we want to preview it a little bit? Because I have not seen. I know one of the premieres like a double ep, and I one of them's out. I have not seen it.
I haven't seen either. So let's save it.
But my basic feel on season one is pretty good.
I'm gonna save my thoughts. And let's jump to because you got some stuff going on these next couple of days. I was surprised to hear about 7 out of the next 10 days you're going to fish shows. Is that right?
I'm not sure if that count is correct because my first one's not till Friday. Starting Friday, I will see 7 fish shows in in 9 days.
It's 7 shows in 9 days. Now,
yeah, so it'll be this Friday and Saturday. I'm up in Washington State at the Gorge, which is, I think, undisputably one of the 2 or 3 most incredible and beautiful music venues in the country. Maybe the most, although I have not been to Red Rocks, so I'll reserve judgment. Then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I will be in San Francisco seeing them at Bill Graham Civic Center.
And also then, one of the most beautiful venues in our country.
That's definitely not true. Okay. It's a pretty garbage venue, but it's a great location and size. Unfortunately, it doesn't always have great sound. Anyway, let's not nitpick about concert venues. So 3 there, 2 in Washington, 3 there, and then 2 more the following weekend in Southern California.
So, you and I have talked about fish a lot over the years.
I'm wearing a fish shirt right now.
I don't think we've talked about it on this particular podcast. Am I crazy?
I think we've obliquely referenced the possibility of talking about it, but no, I don't think we've ever actually really gotten into it.
So for those of you who are just coming into this discussion, I am not a fan of fish.
I would describe you as a hater.
Yeah, that's probably fair. That's probably fair. I think objectively, I don't like their music, you know what I mean, and I do really feel like I've given it a pretty fair run, fair hearing.
You feel that way?
I'll give you my bona fides. Colts heard these a million times. I've listened to albums. I've been to multiple shows. I've made a concerted effort. It's been a while, but I've made a concerted effort at various points in my life to try to like fish, and it just never took. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I do like the Ben and Jerry's ice cream. So I'm not
fish food. That's good stuff. No question.
So
chocolate fudge chunks. Come on.
But I also am a hater in that I don't like the culture and the signifiers and the whatever. It's just not me. I think both of those terms are fair.
Yes. What's interesting is I also don't love the culture. I love a lot about the culture, but I'm not like a big hippie or a big camper or, someone who does a whole lot of weird drugs. And I don't necessarily.
He is someone that does a whole lot of normal drugs, by the way. We should make that clear.
Yeah.
Just not the weird ones.
Yeah. Well, not hard ones, to be more direct. I'm an old man, you know. I stick to the simple things in life.
Right.
But to me, okay, so I think there are different appeals for different people. To me, it is very simply that this is a band who I think pretty objectively is the most musically adept group of musicians playing what might be called popular music. And I don't think there's really much debate in that respect. There's probably better guitarists than Trey and better bassists than Mike and so on and so forth. They're not playing together in a band that's in the zeitgeist.
I'll be free to admit I don't have one on the top of my head, but I bet I could come up with a couple of examples.
I'd love to hear them if you can.
But I'm not going to dispute musicianship of Phish. No,
you have four essentially virtuoso level musicians playing music together.
They're great players. No one's going to take that away from them.
Exactly. That's the one thing you really can't take away from them is they are four tremendous musicians. And for me, I'm a kid who grew up playing mostly the drums, but music in general, and playing in jazz bands and getting involved in improvisational music. And to me, although I have a lot of musical loves from hip hop to indie rock to old blues, to me, improvisational music of all kinds is really operating at a higher level and engaged in something more essential than any other music. And that doesn't mean I don't love, and I mean love, as an example, the new Chance record. Or I'm trying to think of a recent rock record I've loved, but the D'Angelo record that came out a year and a half ago or whatever that was. Mm-hmm. That's obviously not rock, but that doesn't mean that there aren't albums of, again, popular, not pop, but music that's truly in the zeitgeist as opposed to like weird fusion players. I love some of that stuff for what it is, but to me, improvising and playing music live and experimenting and listening and playing off of each other, that to me is sort of the peak of music in general.
Now,
and there's simply nobody else doing it in the way and at the level that Phish is. Other jam bands, for the most part, are just not as good. And I kind of hear, I think when I listen to a band like Umphrey's McGee or Hot Tuna or whatever other jam band that's not Phish, I hear what a lot of people hear when Phish is on, which is something that's not really together, that doesn't sound great, and doesn't – it's just not great.
I think we've kind of hit on I think the center of our dispute almost right here. Maybe you've done a good job of boiling it down to the essence of what Phish is. This is a taste thing. But I agree with your premise that Phish are – great musicians, and they're doing the they're playing improvisational music, and where I get off is the notion that higher level improvisational music is the best thing a band of virtuosos can do. I almost actually think that it's the worst thing that a band of virtuosos... It's literally the thing I least want to see them do, is get up there and show me how much they're experimenting. And I don't, like... It reminds me of... This is going to be a weird analogy.
I think by weird you probably mean insulting, but go ahead.
No. maybe you'll find it insulting. Do you remember the hair metal band Mr. Big?
Certainly not.
Okay. So there are a lot of these kind of bands.
Is there a song that you have in mind?
Well, actually, they did have a big, huge hit song it's very antithetical to, I think, the kind of band they were actually trying to be. It was called "To Be With You" as a an acoustic ballad. Remember the video with the guy on the train?
That one.
But Mr. Big was a band, and there were a few of these different kinds of bands right in that scene, because you did have a lot of guys right in the hair metal scene who wanted to shred, grew up shredding, were really good guitar players, right, or whatever.
Sure.
So
I mean, that's the thing with Van Halen, right?
Yeah, yeah. So Mr. Big was a band with Paul Gilbert, I believe was the guy's name, who was like, you know, a pro-level ace guitarist, studio guy, one of those guys who would write columns in the guitar magazines, you know. Yep. Guitar nerds loved him. They had a bass player who was maybe kind of the – named Billy Sheehan, who was kind of like the heavy metal – you know, mm-hmm. he was that guy. He was the bass nerd guy,
right,
of metal. And they joined up,
rapid fire,
yeah, in this hair metal band. Yeah. And yep. You know, and they had this one hit that was disappointing. And just generally, their output was disappointing. And there were a lot of those kinds of metal bands where you'd be like, "Oh, Steve Vai is playing in this thing," you know.
Well, or there's
any,
a difference.
Any band
to
Joe Satriani's ever been in, you know what I mean? Like,
well, Joe, but there's a difference because Joe Satriani is taking a piece of music, drawing, circling a big section, and then during that section, just noodling. And I'm not – that's not meant to be a horrible insult. These guys are great noodlers. But what Fish does is not just trade solos. What Fish does is not just – set up a song structure and then let Trey go nuts over it. Although there's plenty of that. I mean, don't get me wrong. That happens. The moments that I go to the shows for are the ones where the whole band is exploring musically some theme or situation or what have you, where the whole band is it's something that, again, it's really the only thing to – the only reference point is jazz, where it's got where you're listening to each other and moving the song forward, playing off of one another, playing different things back and forth to each other, all sort of within the structure of what you've created, and sort of the peak. And I think a lot of deep musically inclined fish heads would say a similar thing. The moment I'm there for is when a song that starts in one place and then through improvisation moves to a new place where you set on a new core melody or refrain, and then it begins to play off that, and then that moves to a new refrain, and then you get within this one song a few different, usually very funky, which is sort of my thing, just like musical jams where the music moves itself forward because guys are listening to each other and playing off of each other. And I think most of the hair metal stuff that you're talking about is one or two guys just showing off how talented they think they are. And they may be, but just showing off their skills inside the framework of a specific song. There's not really any musical exploration there. It's just, look at what I can do.
Yeah,
and I think the good moments of Fish are much, much more than that.
Like, I just – and I think this, again, comes back to, like, a taste thing. Like, just listening to you describe that, I get two feelings. The first is, like, wow, like, it's cool. Like, I enjoy seeing the level of passion and depth that you bring to considering all of this.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's neat, and I love that people are passionate about music that way.
And I would add, at that juncture, I would just sneak in the idea that I don't know what percentage of people at a Fish show are thinking right about it on that level. I suspect it's rather small.
I think
that is the crew that I run in, is like dudes that are there digging on the deep, deep jams,
yeah,
music.
So the first part of that is, oh, wow, that's cool. The second part of that, for me, the second feeling I have is, oh my God, that sounds awful. I want to put down these headphones and walk away.
Well, it's interesting. You know, what are the first things you listened to? Like, growing up, what was your hook into music?
Well, so, I have a theory. I don't know if we've ever talked about this.
I'm not sure we've gone this deep, no.
I feel like I must have brought it up at some point, but I think everyone has a musical journey in their life, right? And that you start always at, you know, at the simple, at the poppiest things, right?
Uh-huh.
And gradually move forward on this kind of line of complexity, and some people get a lot further down that line along their interest of complexity, and some people, you know, some people just stay in pop and they never ever really feel like an interest in exploring complexity beyond the, you know, the latest thing in the R&B charts.
And some of that, I think, is just like really, truly genetically, like how much musical inclination do you have?
Yeah. So the first things that I listened to were, you know, top 40 radio when I was 5-6 years old. I was pretty religious. I used to.
Do you have Touchstones? I have a Touchstone.
I used to listen to. Well, I have lots of Touchstones, but I used to listen to like America. I would record American Top 40 with Casey Kasem and like listen to all the hits and do all that stuff. And then
that, you know what that is? Is that's the birth of a young radio DJ.
Yeah,
is
for sure.
Right there,
for sure. And I graduated to like U2. And you know, and INXS and some of those things in the mid 80s.
You're the first person who's ever been accused of graduating to INXS.
yeah, for sure. And then REM was, I think, you know, if you're talking about Touchstones.
REM was huge for me,
big turning point for me. I'm always fascinated
My Touchstone, though, the reason I thought of it is because this pops into my head every time someone talks about, like, how you start listening to music. I mean, obviously, look, my parents had a lot of good music around. Neither of them are huge fanatics, but they had a lot of good music around, whether it was, you know, the Beatles or Skeletons in the Closet or what have you. But the first thing I can remember being like, oh, this is the balls. This is the jam. This is my music, and I am fired up about it, is when I bought the Ka-Single for Technotronic's Pump Up the Jam.
Oh, wow.
Like, I can picture the cassette tape in my hand. That's 1989, by the way. So I was seven or eight years old when I managed to get that into my hands. And man, it was huge for me. It was like, whoa, this is my music. It's all happening now. And then, you know, from there it was TLC and all that good stuff. But, Technotronic is the one that pops into my head. Is like, that's the first time I remember being like, whoa, music.
Well, I'll give you – now, I was into music, and obviously I listened to a lot of records before this. And the primary way you can talk about giving out your age – by the way, I'm talking about actual records, like a lot of these things I was listening to you on vinyl.
My first music experiences that I can remember are Billy Joel on vinyl.
And the primary way that I would get these records was Columbia House, right? The record club.
Sure. Yeah. I did that for sure.
Long time.
And BMG. Did you ever do BMG?
Yeah, yep. Did them both.
And I was in hock up to some of those people for a while because I would join the clubs not reading the fine print and then have to buy the like 8 CDs over the next 2 years or whatever it was. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. I just split it with my parents, so they were handling it.
That was
they
smart.
They get some records. I get some records. It all worked out. But then the first record that I went out and bought, and I think it's actually an interesting touchstone for this conversation, the first record that I went and bought with my own money and was really excited about, like went to a store and purchased, was Vivid by Living Color.
Wow, okay.
Which was just a huge eye opener for me, and definitely a gateway in terms of listening to harder rock stuff. Mm-hmm. I went kind of into a metal thing, but that is a band to me that is a lot like the way you describe Phish, where you're talking about four superhero level musicians. I was just
really
getting
great.
Into, you know, I was just starting to play bass guitar, and Muzz Skillings, who was the bass player on that on those first couple of Living Color records, is brilliant. Obviously Vernon Reid is a storied guitar player, and there's a lot of jazz influences in some of the stuff they do, lots of influences from all kinds of music, and that stuff really appealed to me. But I think that I've always needed more structure, I think, in my music than a band like Phish is going to provide. And I like moments of people going off and coming back together, but it always, to me, needs to be within the framework of a song. And I just feel like bands, all jam bands, but, you know, we're using sort of Phish as the archetype, I think you could say. Like, just there's just too much coloring outside the lines for my own taste. I'm curious, and we don't necessarily need to turn this into a referendum on Phish.
Well, I do think, just quickly, I think that's the fundamental disconnect for because, look, there are idiots who don't care about music and who can't get past the, like, hackneyed stereotypes of jam bands and Phish and what have you, and they're not really worth talking about or two. What always interests me is when someone like you, who's very passionate about music, is uninterested in a band that I think is doing music so well. And I think, yeah, I think we've hit on the exact thing. Yeah. Is like, for whatever reason, for you, coloring outside the lines in the way that they do it is uninteresting, and I don't want to say unimpressive, but like,
yeah, it's not unimpressive. It just doesn't touch. It doesn't touch me on any kind of emotional level. Like, it leaves me cold. Their music.
Yeah, and I wonder what that is. I mean, I don't know if that's just something inherent to you, if that's something about the way you started listening to music and sort of what your musical journey has been, or if it's just, you know, an oddity of taste. But I do think when there are people who care about music that don't care or dislike Phish, I think that's the difference.
So
I'm really always searching, even when I listen to stuff that's not really doing this, I'm always looking for interesting flares, for that added twist to go a little outside of what you might expect or what might naturally follow the course of, you know, the easiest course of plotting out where a song or album might go. And I don't mean to say that, like, I'm viewing it more on a more complicated level than you are, because I don't think that's the case. But to me, there's something special about that added twist. And to you, I think there's something special about songcraft and about creating something that doesn't need the added twist, yeah, because it is essentially what it should be.
And I'm more, I don't know, like, I think just as a, like, a fan of a guy going to shows, like, I'm more into almost like stagecraft and spectacle. Uh-huh. You
show
know what
me
I mean?
What, show me what you can do from a presentation and put it. It's like if you go to a musical. If you love Les Mis and you go see a show of Les Mis, there are things you're looking for that you want to be done perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to going in thinking, what interesting experiment will I see tonight?
Yeah, well, you know, it's like you know, I went to see this dude Yellow Wolf at a radio show a couple of years ago.
I can't advocate that.
So, yeah, there are a lot of people who hate Yellow Wolf, and that's fine.
You mean Trucker Eminem?
yeah, right. Okay, so
I don't hate him. I don't know much about him. I just like making fun of him.
He's playing this radio show, you know, and he's got a single on the radio. It's an alternative station. People are like kind of clearly not getting what he's about,
mm-hmm.
And he's got his set list, and it's like a tape to the mic or whatever. And at some point, he kind of realizes things aren't working. And takes the set list and lights it on fire, like with the microphone attached.
Yeah, and, I think we have talked about.
Yeah,
this
I think
actually,
we think
yeah.
I told this story right. And the roadie's freaking out, you know. And he winds up doing like this acapella cover of "Friends in Low Places," and he's doing all this stuff. He doesn't play a single at all. And like, there's to me that kind of unpredictability of like, hey, you don't know where this night is gonna go, and there's a tension between performer and audience.
Uh-huh.
Like, and you sort of don't know what the guy's going to do, and it feels a little bit dangerous. Like, I'm more interested in that level of unpredictability than, like, are these guys going to do if play a few notes that I'm not expecting, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think there's the unpredictability that I'm talking about is a more subtle thing than the one that you're talking about. Because in a lot of ways, you know, Phish, the audience is in the bag. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So many people there have seen half the shows on the tour and, you know, dozens of shows in their life and know where to clap and sing and do all the crowd participation stuff that's involved in a lot of Phish shows. It's a captive and, you know, it's preaching to the choir. But and then sort of subtly within that, and I don't know how what percentage of the crowd is even interested in this subtlety, but I certainly am. There are musical things that can happen that are unpredictable. There are also those other things that can happen. I mean, you're not going to have an audience that's uninterested like this Yellow Wolf thing you're talking about, but you are going to have weird staging stuff. Maybe they bring out trampolines and jump up and down for a little bit. Like there are fun twists of that sort that I also enjoy. But again, I'm mostly there because of the musical unpredictability. And yeah, there's a core difference there between I'm here to see a spectacle where some of my favorite music is played, and I'm here to see, you know, musically something new and interesting and explorative.
I think it's telling that two of my favorite live bands are Pearl Jam and Radiohead, who are bands that share some of the same characteristics. Like particularly Pearl Jam is a band where people go to lots of shows and they keep count.
And they jam out a little bit.
They do. And it's like Pearl Jam is like the right amount of jamming for me, right? Uh-huh. Like a lot of the intrigue in the Pearl Jam show is what songs are they going to play. And then
catalog is ridiculous.
And they'll play literally anything from it. They played a song. They played the Angel, which was their 1993 Christmas single the other night for the first time in 22 years. You know what I mean?
That's amazing. And that sort of stuff, the Cult of Fish leads to that kind of stuff too, which I think is super cool.
And like I went to a show where some guy brought a sign that had been like, it had been 2,000 shows since you'd played this song. And they just played it. Yeah.
Stuff like that definitely happens at Fish shows where Trey will like look out into the audience and be like, man, that guy has been carrying that Fluffhead sign around since three cities ago. We got to play it for him.
Right. You know? And I like that. By the way, level of unpredictability.
Quick aside, since I happened for unknown reasons to mention Fluffhead, there was definitely a dude with a giant Fluffhead sign, which is a Fish song, behind the plate at Home Run Derby yesterday.
Great. Amazing. I just feel like a Pearl Jam song never gets away from them, and I think I like that, and I think that not the Fish songs get away from them, like where they don't know where it's going.
They deliberately lead it away from where the song might have been.
Yeah, yeah.
No, and I think look, as a result,
you're attracted to that and I'm not, essentially.
Yeah. Exactly. And because that is the modus operandi of Fish, because if you watch the documentary Bittersweet Motel, which is sort of I don't know if I'd call it the standard, but it's a quality documentary if you want to understand a little more about what's going on with Fish. They do a pretty good job. And Trey has this one kind of pontification point. By the way, Trey Anastasio is the lead guitarist and singer of Fish. And he has this sort of point where he pontificates briefly about, he essentially says, I don't care, and he uses more colorful language, but he essentially says, I don't care if we miss a change here or I forget a lyric of one of the, you know, 50 covers or 300 originals that we play. Because for me, it's about that moment where we hit something new that is exciting and awesome. And, you know, I think that does a great job of explaining exactly why it appeals to me, because I'm not a huge lyrics guy or like a great. So you missed a change and it sounded a little messy. But like if I want to hear the song played perfectly, I have the album.
Yeah. See, and I am a big lyrics guy. I think that's
and you are a big lyrics guy and a guy who if you go see a show, you want to hear the awesome version that you heard on the album, essentially. Not that it'll be identical.
Not that I want to hear. Yeah. Not necessarily the version I've heard on the album, but I want to hear an awesome version. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's the idea that they wrote this song and spent however much time putting it on the album in the way that presumably they thought was the best version. And so while they might do some interesting things live, the idea is basically they wrote a great song, so play a great song.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's always been like, yeah, they wrote a great song, but I have that song. I own that song in my music collection. I don't necessarily
not at this experience, though. You know what I mean?
Well, but again, I think that's the difference.
You don't own this experience in your music collection.
It is. No, it's different. And I, again, I'm not trying to denigrate your perspective. I think it's as valid as mine. It is just that's the core difference.
Yeah.
It's like what impresses you most, I think, is the songcraft and the creation of this thing that is great. And what impresses me is what you can do with it once it exists.
Yeah, yeah. And look, there's way too much understanding in this discussion, and I do want to ask you.
Go to hell. Just learn to understand music, Madden.
God, such an idiot. Whatever, hippie. I'm curious. So I don't really know where Fish is at as a band right now. Do they are they playing new songs? Are they writing new songs?
Yep.
And what is your interest level in hearing these new songs?
Mild. Mild interest. I sometimes they're good. I don't want to say songwriting's not a strength, because I think songwriting is a strength. But it's a very enjoying a new Fish song usually is very different from the from why I go to shows. You know, the different songs that are new may develop into interesting jams over time, but whether or not that happens is sort of not specifically tied to how good of a song it is from, like, the perspectives you're talking about, from a song craft, from a when I hear it on the album, how impressed
I'm not even talking about a song. I'm just talking about your enjoyment. And I guess maybe the sort of question underneath that is, like, how much does familiarity matter to you at all in your Fish experience?
Very, very, very little. I think there are certain songs that I know because of what they're like. You know, just to pick a random Fish song, there's a song called Wolfman's Brother that came out on Hoist in 1994. And it's still a regular, it's still in the regular jam rotation. And it happens to be a particular sort of funky jam that I love and that I feel like usually turns into exciting new music when it's played live. And so I love to see that live. You know, I could name a few other random Fish songs that I would put in that category. Twist is one. and then there's also the, whoa, I haven't heard this song live since the year 2000. Or, whoa, this is something new and interesting. And sometimes those songs are interesting just because they're new. Sometimes they're interesting because they're exciting new songs that are better than others in some way. And sometimes they're interesting because just by virtue of the structure and sort of general sound of the new song, it leads to interesting jams. So all that holds interest. In terms of this is a new song that I've never heard before and I'm so impressed by the song that it is, I think that happens less, but part of that to me is the nature of being a band that's had this many albums and has written this many songs is that they're not all going to be my favorite. And look, when they play songs I've never heard before live, I'm like, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what it could become. More than I'm like, what a great song.
Yeah, it's interesting. I can't get away from the word interesting because I was thinking about how you used that word probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 times kind of in that explanation. And the whole time, all I could think about was like, yeah, I am not interested at all. Like, I find none of this interesting. You know what I mean? Not in what you were saying, but just like the idea of all of those things, like it just doesn't hold my interest. You know what I mean?
I think
not that I can't respect it, but it doesn't interest me.
I'm going to make a weird analogy because I think your view of Fish is a little bit like my view of the television show Curb Your Enthusiasm. I think it's funny. So in that respect, it's not like your view of Fish, and I think it's enjoyable to watch at times, and when I watch it, I laugh. But at the end of the day, I kind of feel like it's Seinfeld rehearsal, and I would rather just watch Seinfeld. Like there's hilarious storylines, and it's this incredible awkward comedy, and I respect that, and I understand why it's good, and I, like I said, I usually laugh when I watch it. And I think, honestly, like, if we started from scratch and I tried to find jam points that would interest you, I could find a lot of them. Now, I'm not saying you would want to go to a show and watch these jams happen live, but I think musically, some of the stuff they get to in these jams is stuff that could be up your alley.
I don't doubt that. I'm sure there are moments at a show that I would enjoy, but I think part of, like, I think part of just the pit of dread I feel about these kind of shows is just how endless they seem. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How endless they feel.
I think in a way, my point was going to be that even if I found those points that were up your alley, those jam points that were musically interesting to you because they hit the right musical notes, and I don't mean that literally, I mean figurative notes, to draw you in musically, I think what you'd rather see is, if you like that music in that part of the jam, you would rather see a song written musically that sounds like that, that's a complete song that is, you know, there's more time and effort put into the crafting and development of it. And that's sort of my position on Curb Your Enthusiasm, is like, I get it, I see the skill and the talent, and I understand why people like it, and it makes sense to me, but I would rather see the sort of stylized, finished product that is Seinfeld, which to me mostly is just Curb Your Enthusiasm type situations and plot lines that get locked in to sort of the best version.
Yeah. Do you? And this is way left field. Do you ever like songs? And I think The National kind of write a lot of these songs. LCD Sound System has a couple where it's mostly the same thing, but they just sort of keep adding like one more layer as the song goes, and they sort of just keep adding one more thing until you get to the end, and now all of these things are here, and it's this big, huge thing that's sort of like the epic climax of all the little things that have been slowly added before it.
More in electronic music. Like, I like that from LCD Sound System. I like that from Pretty Lights. I think when music that is made up in that, you know, RJD2 does that a lot. I like that sort of stuff from a DJ. I don't like The National. For me, like, if you're playing your instrument, I think it comes down to this. If you're playing your instruments live, I want to see A, how good you are, and B, can you do something that interests me at a level that I'm not getting from your album?
It's interesting, because The National, obviously, huge Dead fans.
Not a huge Dead fan, though.
Yeah.
A lot of the Dead do some of the stuff I'm talking about, Fish-wise, and they more as they got later into their career. But a lot of it was really just like bluegrass folk music with Jerry Garcia noodling on top of it, which is fine.
It's not fine. Matt Kolsky, I continue to not understand you at all. I enjoy that about you. Yes. We didn't get to the one thing that I really wanted to talk about today. But we're out of time, and I think I can save it till next time. The golf thing. I want to talk about the golf thing.
Oh, we've been saving the golf thing for a while.
Let's just save it again, because I gotta get going. I
Derek hates golf even more than he hates fish. That's the preview.
That
of
is
our golf
absolutely true. Yes. I want to reassign some homework this week.
I told you I do my homework. You don't have to reassign it.
It's sort of reassigning. The circus is back on Showtime.
Yeah. It's funny. When you said earlier that you were like, well, there's the lull before the conventions. I was like, oh, yeah, the circus is coming back.
Yeah. It came back last week.
I'm behind. All right.
So,
okay.
Watch that. I think it's going to be great.
So,
coming into the conventions.
So it turns out you did have to reassign the homework.
Yes. There you go. So,
My bad.
Even if you did it the first time, obviously, these are new episodes and you should watch them.
Yes.
I don't know how many people are watching the circus, and I think it's really good.
I agree.
Good.
You know, I watched when you told me to at the end of the sort of first part of this season. And I think we've talked about this before. I'm pretty much a opt out guy as far as politics go because it makes me too upset and depressed. But this show was a great way to stay engaged and follow the stories in an entertaining fashion and hopefully not get too infuriated.
There's some great footage of the in the most recent episode of the FBI director, James Comey, testifying in front of Congress. You know, and they're trying to grill him about his findings on the Hillary thing. And right. You can actually see one of the guys from the show, like, just sitting there right over his kind of right shoulder about 2-3 rows behind.
Uh-huh.
And you're kind of like, man, these guys really are just right there all the time. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like
this, yeah.
Like they're just sort of hanging out in the back the whole time as these sort of momentous things are happening. And I thought it was kind of neat.
It's embedded reporting on an extreme level, no question about it. And I think I made this comparison when we talked about it a couple months ago. It reminds me of this documentary Spin about the 96 election, is it, with Clinton and Dole?
Yeah.
that just like even the lightest behind the scenes glimpse on these people is fascinating.
Sure is, because look,
you have to be such a particular and honestly bizarre type of person to even get into this business.
Yeah, you do. There's something fantastical about being, you know, on an ego level, on an intelligence level, on a, you know what I mean, about being this kind of person, and I find those things fascinating. You know, regardless of what I think of Donald Trump or his candidacy, like stories about inside the Trump campaign, I'll read all the time. They're great. By the way, GQ did a profile of Trump's communication director a couple weeks ago that kind of made some news. If you haven't read that, that's really worth checking out as well. Some really great inside glimpses into the Trump campaign and that.
That's just going to depress me for sure, though.
I don't think it will.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Because his, you know, fantastical is a great word to sort of talk about his everyday existence as well. So I think you might enjoy it.
Sure.
You got anything you want people to check out?
No, that's. I think the circus is a good one. I'm going to be checking out so much fish and doing so much driving around the West Coast over the next couple weeks that I don't know when I'll get caught up.
It sounds like we're probably not doing a pod next week, is what it sounds like, right?
Well, we can. Yeah, you know what? I think that's probably best. Let's take next week off because. Or do we want to play it by? I mean, look, there's a chance I'll be totally down. It's going to be. I might be kind of a mess.
All right. Well, we may talk to you guys next week.
That might be entertaining. I don't know. Is me as a mess?
Yes.
Like four or five shows into seven fish shows in 9 days. Is that? I think that's something that people might want to hear.
I'm going to encourage that for sure.
Okay.
All right, guys. We will maybe talk to you next week, and if not, soon enough.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.